Thank you, Grandpa. I always wanted this toy. Oh, wow, this is cool. Oh, thank you so much. I'm sorry, Mom. I know I said I would clean up. I didn't do it. I'm sorry. What do you mean Grandpa died? I just saw him the other day. He brought me that great toy. Dad, you didn't knock before coming in. I don't believe it. Emotion. Emotion is the human experience. Feeling, emotion. Emotion that is the expression of a feeling. Connected, yes. Emotion, of course, is what we come to understand what a person is feeling. It's how God has made us. So what is emotion specifically? How is it defined? Emotion is quite complex, but important, because as you, of course, are ministering to people where they are, emotion just is. And there's a whole range of emotions, just as I demonstrated with the examples of Grandpa, Mom, Dad, a colleague, a friend, life circumstances, life events. There are many emotions that we express. What is an emotion? An emotion is the mental and physical feeling state that directs our intention and guides our behavior. Now, you can see in these great pictures all the different emotions of surprise, anger, joy, elation, feeling great, or that whole thing of shock and awe, or frustration, concern. Many different emotions. Again, that mental and physiological feeling state that directs our attention and guides our behavior. Perhaps today you have been through a whole range of emotions when it comes to your parents or your spouse, your children. And of course, with kids, if you're the dad, you're the mom, you're saying, oh, I know just what I had this morning or last night at dinner. And my son didn't want to tell me what was going on at school because he was annoyed. Or the tears of your daughter because of that breakup. Emotion is tangible, is that state that reveals where a person is at and how a person truly is feeling, or maybe not. It gets complex. Let's look at some of the dynamics of emotion. The dynamics of emotion relate to these with the whole thing of cognitive appraisal, which is cognitive, meaning the brain, the thinking, interpretations that accompany emotions. So you have the stimulus of the growling dog. There's a physiological arousal. The heart rate increases. The surprise is there in the face. And then the cognitive label, that's scary. You put a value, you put a label on the experience. The dog is growling at you. Or the dog is trying to get your attention and giving you a lot of affection. But in this case, it's fear. And the emotion is fear. And you can fill in all different kinds of stimuli here. when it comes to, again, like I was saying about Grandpa was the great toy to the child. Or the news that Grandpa died. And the whole stimulus is there. And then Mom catching you lying or not following through with what you said you're going to do. And then there's that response. Emotion. Emotion truly is an indicator of how a person is processing their lives at the moment, during the day. For example, when it comes to depression, that all the emotion about depression, being listless, being feeling numb, still in shock, maybe trauma, the person seems far away, arm's length, as opposed to the opposite, where the person is joyous, ecstatic, things have gone great today, can't believe it. Or there's a lot of concerns, and there's stress, and oh, you can see it on the person's face. Psychologists have been measuring and observing emotion for decades. And as they measure emotion and how it works with people, they've come up with a way to measure and understand how a stimuli will then evoke, bring out an emotional response. There's this tool, this instrument, that shows us how, and it's in your textbook, it's right there in the emotion chapter, that shows you, gives you the idea of how intense an emotion can be, bringing therefore an unpleasant response as opposed to a pleasant response, or a mild response, or a mild emotion that is unpleasant or pleasant. So, for example, in the top left quadrant, between intense and unpleasant, there's afraid, alarmed, angry, frustrated, annoyed, distressed. To the flip side, with intense, pleasant responses of being astonished, amused, excited, happy, delighted, glad, and pleased. And below that, you have the other side of the mild response of miserable, sad, depressed. To the pleasant side of serene, calm, relaxed. There are many emotions we can measure and begin to categorize how they fit, how they occur, and why. And this is the work, thanks to Dr. William Cannon and also Dr. Philip Bard. Hence, we have the Cannon-Bard theory, as well as Dr. Carl Lang and William James. Hence, the Lang and James theories. Well, what are they? What are these theories? Well, in your book, we see this graphic as well. The James-Lang theory looks at both stimuli and response. Stimulus-response emotion coming from the bear. And the bear was the most intense stimuli that James and Lang could see an intense response coming, again, going back to our other graphic, and also Cannon and Bard using the bear as well, but in different ways. James and Lang stuck to one specific response. Hence, the heart pounds, there's trembling, sweating, and a running away response, flight, because of the fear. And Cannon and Bard said, okay, well, we first look at the fear expression on the face, and then they separate it out. Then we look at the heart pounding, trembling, sweating, running away. And those two need to be understood separately. Whereas James and Lang just put it together as one. And then we have Schachter and Singer that came up with the two-factor theory, which we'll look at here more specifically in a minute. They look at the heart pounding, trembling, sweating, and then they add to it, that is one scary bear, I am afraid of it. There's a thinking process happening in the whole moment of fear. So from James Lang, Cannon Bard, Schefter Singer, we also look at another stimulus. Now, in the more modern version of it, from the bear, of course, these theories are quite old, but relevant and transcendent. And you see the sight of the oncoming car in the more modern example. The perception of the stimuli is the car is coming right at me. And the car is not slowing down. Well, the James Lang theory, the pounding heart, there's arousal. Cannon Bard, arousal with a pounding heart, and also fear, which is the emotion. And then Schefter Singer, two-factor theory, is there's a pounding heart, arousal, and the cognitive label, I am afraid of that. Hence, from the pounding heart of arousal, physiological, to the cognitive label, I'm afraid of that car, to the fear, which is the emotion. So what these theorists help us to do, and of course, getting back to James Lang theory on the other side there, you have then the emotion of fear as the next response after the arousal response. You can see that these theorists wanted to break it up for us. What exactly happens with that whole moment of the bear, the whole moment of the car coming on, or let's say the Mack truck, the big truck, the lorry, coming down that road and not stopping, and you're standing right in the middle of the road, and you freeze. You don't know what to do because of fear, that emotional response, and that physiological state and emotional state where that shock and awe happen. Well, the theories of emotion are also expressed here, of course, in that two-factor theory, as I referred to, from James and Lang, Cannon and Bard. Now we want to look at the whole two-factor theory by Schefter and Singer. They broke it down even more with the two-factor theory. The two-factor theory they define as the experience of emotion is determined by the intensity of the arousal. They begin to measure more specific the intensity of the arousal. Not just the arousal, like Lang and Bard, and also Cannon and Bard, than James and Lang, but they looked at the intensity of the arousal to begin with. How much? And so they say, they looked at this, the experience of the emotion is determined by the intensity of the arousal we are experiencing, but that the cognitive, the thinking, appraisal of the situation determines what the emotion will be. So in this graphic, we see this two-factor theory in motion. The sight of the oncoming car is there. It's the perception of stimulus. Then to the cognitive label, I am afraid. But then they break it down into two possible emotive responses. Fear, and then also the pounding heart. Arousal. But then they can be connected. And the fear may not be expressed right away with that whole hand up and surprise in the eyes. Perhaps it's just the pounding heart and that there's that state of freezing. Hence, you have the two-factor theory in motion. Well, apply this two-factor theory then to also other situations. Because when we interact with each other, as we relate with each other with feelings and emotions, with arousal and emotional response, we then look at nonverbal communication. Nonverbal communication. Now this of course seems quite elementary. However, what theorists and also practitioners are then saying is we can observe nonverbal communication. You cannot not communicate. Now this traipses over into the communication discipline and the communication arts and also the communication sciences, because what we then see is we see that there in fact is a definitive response with emotion, maybe not verbal, but nonverbal. There's body language, kind of like this. or kind of like this, or this, or that. Sitting back, not saying a word, observing, or engaged. What theorists did with this nonverbal communication, we're not going to get into a whole lot of nonverbal communication theory here, but we want to observe and note that there is nonverbal communication that is very important. Now, especially when you're in a counseling session as a pastoral counselor, or you are in a coaching session with coaching, and you're seeing someone like this. They're kind of like this, looking up at the ceiling, looking down at the floor, no eye contact. Or they have a lot of eye contact, they're hanging on your every word. Or they notice that you're not saying a thing because you're listening, which we need to do effectively, and they don't know what to say. Or they have a lot to say, but not yet. Nonverbal. We can learn a lot with what a person really is feeling and saying when they say nothing at all. It's not, you cannot not communicate. So what is nonverbal communication technically? Let's take a look. Nonverbal communication is communication primarily of liking or disliking that does not involve words. So let's look at the five essential types here in this graphic. The five essential types of nonverbal communication used by effective leaders, for instance, is they look at facial expressions, smiling, frowning, the surprise look, the shock look, and then the body language, as I demonstrated earlier. Sitting back, leaning forward, leaning to the side, jumping up for joy. You can see that one cartoon character there, or hands up on each side, saying, I don't know, or shrugging. Body language. Gestures with our hands, our fingers. There are naughty ones, and there are kind ones. As well as proxemics. Proxemics, how close you stand to the other person. Maybe a person wants to be very far away from you, or close to you. As well as haptics. Haptics, using touch to reinforce the message. Now, let's take a look primarily, just for a moment, at proxemics and haptics. With proxemics, we look at the example, for instance, of social class. Again, we're not looking at class necessarily in psychology. However, there's a lot of psychology in class systems. For example, when it comes to the upper class or the elite class, you never, ever in the elite class, the top 1% of the economic class system in the Western society, you never introduce yourself. You are always introduced. Secondly, and this is all based upon social class study, especially with Ruby Payne and her famous book, Understanding a Framework for Poverty. She discusses the class rules. And then, of course, we look at other study where we look at how people are then, how they communicate nonverbally in class systems. Again, going back to elite class, you are introduced by somebody who then says, who is screening you with the other people in the class structure, in the class system, saying, okay, in the same class system of the elite, saying, this person is okay, in other words. We can trust this person. They're not after your money. They're not here to scam you. You're introduced. You're then invited into the circle. And you then nonverbally are there to be then brought into the circle. As well as, there's a certain amount of distance that you have between you and the other person. It's not like up here, between you and the other person in the elite class, again, with that example, in terms of having conversation interpersonally and intimately. No, it's like this. There's a distance. There is a formal posture. You do not get right up to their face. Conversely, in the redneck, if you will, that culture, and then I'm sure you read, those of you who consider yourself rednecks, consider it proud as well, and it's up here in the face. Let me tell you something. Absolutely. And those other cultures and subcultures, up in the face to being distant. Nonverbal communication. That's the proxemics. Because, for instance, if you then say, well, if you come up to a person who is more of the culture that you don't come up to my face, there is a boundary there. And when you come up to that person's face, of course, verbally, you're saying things, but they're not hearing you. It's the nonverbal that they're hearing. And the nonverbal that they're hearing is, you don't respect me. You don't care about me because my boundary is your arm's length with me. Until I invite you in where we can be face-to-face, more intimate, there's a distance I then demand, I require. And the opposite is true with people who prefer for you to get in their face. Why are you standing back there, they think, even though you're only about less than a foot away? I mean, there is a measurement, you know. And they're thinking, if you're not close to me, then you're not respecting me as well. Different people, different rules, different nonverbals. Nonverbal communication matters. And then the thing of touch, touching the shoulder, touching the arm, touching the face. Now, touching the face is more intimate. Touching the elbow, that tends to be, to some people, very intimate, others not. The shoulder, that's pretty well accepted. Although, again, depends on the culture. Nonverbal communication. And nonverbal communication can also be seen, of course, in this other graphic, where, again, how do we perceive what the other person is trying to communicate without saying a word? Or what a child, such as this child, is trying to communicate with his nonverbals and his fingers, his hand on his head. If we look at one picture, he's very happy. The other picture, he's laughing. The other picture, he's confused. Another picture, he's bored. Another picture, he's trying to just play. And another picture, he's kind of shy. Kids are different than adults. But again, nonverbals. You cannot not communicate because when it comes to body language has many different dynamics to it. It's a fascinating discipline to study in terms of the psychology of it and the communication side of it. When it comes to movement, expression, posture, physical gesture, fingers, hands, body, facials, handshakes, frustration through facial expressions, look, ideas, all these great words. Astonished, it's quite surprising. You can say a lot without saying a word. Hence, emotion. Emotion often is more nonverbal and verbal too, especially when it comes to sadness and expressing our frustrations, the to the with the sadness, to the ha, the joy and the laughter. But really, when it comes to emotion, it is a state that guides our physiological and emotional action, reaction, dynamic, and also communication. From here, we then go from emotion then to our next topic on stress.